One, two, three.
Welcome to Three Song Stories, the place where songs and memories are transmuted into conversation and storytelling. Thanks for listening. I'm Mike Kinirie. Our guest this week is Kirsten Hines. Kirsten is a writer, photographer, and environmental educator who started out as a wildlife biologist but found herself being drawn towards storytelling with images and words versus collecting data, so made a big pivot in that direction. Kirsten grew up in the Philippines but has been based in Miami since 1998 when she moved to South Florida to get her master's in biology. After finishing grad school, she traveled around New Zealand, Australia, Southeast Asia, China, and the Bahamas. Right before she left on that adventure, her fellow students gave her first camera, and that's when she started seeing the world from a different perspective. Her bio says she has, quote, been stashed under thorny bushes by Maasai in Kenya, had her lunch stolen by monkeys in the forests of Borneo, battled crocodiles in Australia, faced down a bowl of boiled frogs in China, and checked off her last continent with penguins in the Antarctic. Kirsten's photos and writings have appeared in numerous exhibitions and publications, including 8 books, the latest of which is Wild Florida, An Animal Odyssey. It's like a conversational field guide that explores Florida's animal diversity and its blending of creatures from the tropics with those from North America. Good morning, Kirsten. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing very well. You drove over this morning.
I did indeed.
See any wildlife?
Some vultures. Mm. Yeah, always exciting. Actually, I saw some roseate spoonbills fly over, too. That was exciting.
They're mostly, well, not, I don't want to say back, but they're more back now, right?
Yeah, and they're moving around. So, yeah, we're seeing them more often than we used to. Let's put it that way.
Do you always have a camera handy in case something miraculous happens?
I almost always have a camera on me.
Hmm. Like a real camera.
Like a real camera. Hmm. Yeah, that's why the big bag.
Yeah. You even brought it inside.
Well, I'm not going to leave it in my car.
You're going to take any pictures during the sometimes there's these little lizards that show up in the studio. You can get one of those.
Yeah, maybe, you know, if it's far enough away, it's a long lens.
Oh, right on. Okay, so where did you grow up and how would you describe the musical background of your childhood growing up?
So I'm originally from Seattle, but I actually grew up in the Philippines. So we moved there when I was almost 8, and I stayed there all through high school. So that's where I grew up. My family actually is a very musical family. I'm probably the black sheep. My dad worked his way through college singing in a
quartet.
You're
the off note.
I'm the off note, yeah. Good call. my mom was a pianist. My brother played the French horn. And I always sang, and I was good at singing. But to be honest, like, I couldn't read the notes. I would just listen, and I would, you know, when the notes on the music sheet went up, I would be like, okay, we go up now. But I had no idea what I was reading.
What brought you and your family to the Philippines?
So my dad was a pastor, and he decided he would become a missionary, which is a whole family vocation.
So do you have musical memories associated with Seattle in terms of, like, what was being played around the house or what you – do you have siblings, you said?
Yeah, I have one brother.
Or is it not till the Philippines where those memories start? Because, you know, 8's kind of that dividing line.
Yeah. No. Well, so we lived in Seattle when I was born, and then we actually moved to Prosser and then Ithaca, New York for a year before we went to the Philippines. And I remember those years. I don't remember much about Seattle other than apparently I was, like, picking blackberries and came face to face with a raccoon, and I thought that was really exciting.
It's like Snow White.
That's my only memory of Seattle. But in Prosser, I remember, you know, my dad always singing the Hallelujah chorus at Christmas time. So I remember him walking around the house practicing his tenor solo. We had a record player, and my brother and I would play the records and dance around to, you know, musicals mostly. My parents mostly listened to classical music. And when we got to the Philippines, like, they really like performances and they really like singing. And so we were kind of like the family singing group that we, you know.
You were the Filipino Von Trapps.
There you go. And they would, you know, they would put us on show all the time.
So you lived in the Philippines all the way through, like, high school?
Yeah, I came back for college.
Wow. So describe what music was like for you for those, you know, 10 years. I mean, was there American music or was it non-American music?
It was very behind the times, first of all. So I missed the 80s. Popular 80s music, like, doesn't exist for me, which most people my age, that's like their music, right? I don't know most of it.
That's a big blind spot.
Yeah. And, but also, I mean, at home, we weren't listening to that. And my parents would try really to let us listen to the traditional music. And, it wasn't really until, and I was homeschooled for my first several years. And so it wasn't until I got into middle school and high school that I started really, even having an awareness that there was this whole world of popular music out there, and started listening to it with friends primarily.
What's your first, like, musically associated memory from your time in the Philippines? Is it the singing from your family? Is there something else that pops out?
I mean, there was a song I learned when we first moved there, a Filipino song that I learned that is still very much in my head.
Can you bring a little?
I can sing you the whole thing. It's short. Tong 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 pakitong kitong may alimango sa daga malaki at masarap mahirap makukuning dahil na hangagat.
What's it mean?
It's about a crab that lives in the ocean and very deep, and they're very hard to catch. And they're tasty, but they bite.
It's like Pixar should pick that up. What do they speak in the Philippines? I know it's kind of a silly question.
Well, they speak lots of languages, but the national language is Tagalog, and that's the one that I learned growing up, although don't ask me to speak too much of it now because most of it's gone.
Is that what that song was in?
Yeah, that was in Tagalog.
Huh. Okay. Well, you ready to do your first song?
Yeah.
Okay. When does your first song take place?
Actually, just after we moved to the Philippines.
Well, perfect. Okay. Yeah. Do you want to tell a story or do you want
to... Let's listen to it first.
Okay. It's this one. all right. This is Kirsten Hines' first song on this week's Three Song Stories. This is I Just Called to Say I Love You by Stevie Wonder. It was released as the lead single on the 1984 soundtrack album for the movie The Woman in Red, which I learned for this show that he wrote all the songs for. That movie, or that song rather, is at least 200% more mellow than I remember it.
Well, apparently you made a liar out of me. I said I don't know the 80s. I didn't know that song was from the 80s.
It's an 80s song. So I haven't listened to that in so long. So what's the story?
So actually that song makes my skin crawl. It's not a pleasant song for me. When we first moved to the Philippines, we were living in a rather slum area, neighborhood. But we lived in this big old church compound, and we lived with other pastors on the compound, and we lived in this tiny little apartment that was just a two-room, not two-bedroom, two-room. So, like, at night, you'd put mosquito netting out, and we would fill the entire room that was, like, the living area, and then the other room was the little kitchen. And that was literally right on the corner. And on one side was this huge trash heap with a guy, an old homeless guy that lived in a broken down car. And he was constantly having to fight off the kids that were going to come and steal from his trash pile. And then on the other corner, there was this little cafe, if you want to call it that, that had a giant jukebox. And that jukebox played all day, all night at an insane volume. And this was one of the songs that was on nearly constantly. And so it was kind of the soundtrack of my life while we lived there. And so, you know, kind of like, and we, you know, we were a very quiet family. You know, we'd have our music, but it was like quiet classical music in the background. And so to have this just like blaring nonstop was like, where have we come?
Did you have any sense of what that song was coming from, the movie, anything like that? I mean, did you even know who Stevie Wonder was?
No, not at all. I didn't know any of these people. I didn't know what they were doing. I just knew this place across the street played this hideous music nonstop. And there's a few songs, and most of them I couldn't tell you what they are. But as soon as they play, I'm like, ooh, yep, that's
okay,
one of them.
Okay, so there are some triggers out there. You can't come to, this was the one
this
you
is
could
the one
remember.
That, yeah, yeah. And then there's another one. The only line I can remember is Ocean's Deep, you know?
Ocean's Deep. Look for a song with the words Ocean's Deep in it. We'll see if we can trigger you.
But the funny thing was, it turns out that, and I don't know, you know, I was a little kid, so I never verified this third hand, but or first hand. But apparently that the only way that place was allowed to have gambling was if they had a dead body. So they would rent dead bodies and have wakes all the time so that they could stay open all night and gamble all night.
I'm speechless. I'm reading, this is a totally crazy aside, I'm reading Tom Robbins' Another Roadside Attraction right now, which sort of strangely intersects with that.
I haven't read that one. I've read some of his stuff, but not that one. That's funny.
You say you didn't really get exposed to 80s music. Is that, would that apply to film and TV and all the other cultural things?
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, we didn't own a TV most of the time. I lived in the Philippines, too. So when I came back for college, it was like the big joke, like makeup sitcoms that Kirsten would, you know, you could tell me it was a real one and I wouldn't know. But they also then would make up all kinds of sitcoms that never occurred. And you could tell me anything and I'd be like, really? Oh, okay.
How radically different, I mean, it sounds like, you know, the two-room place for your family to live would be radically different for almost anybody coming from the United States. But did you, I mean, was that really radically, like, shocking when you got there? Were you like, we're going to live here?
It was shocking for a couple of reasons. One of them was my parents had prepared my brother and I to go live in a mountain tribe in Indonesia. So that's why we had been in New York for a year, was they were learning Indonesian while we were waiting for our visas. And the visas didn't come during that time. And so instead, the organization that was going to be sending my parents said, well, you know, there's this congregation in the Philippines that would really like to have an English pastor while you're waiting. So maybe you can go there for a year while you're waiting for your other visa. So this whole time, I mean, I was taking Indonesian dance. We were eating Indonesian food.
So you had sort of strange culture shock because you didn't go to Indonesia.
Well, not only that, we were supposed to go to this like remote mountain tribe and we're flying into Manila. And at the time, it was the second biggest and most polluted city in the world. And I'm looking down from a plane going, what is this? Like, this is just like black, you know, we're flying into black and cement and concrete. And I was like, where are we going? What is this? And then kind of to make matters worse. And, you know, my parents were just like, they were as lost as we were. And we got greeted at the airport by like this huge group of people that was so excited to have us there. But they immediately wanted to take my parents to go show them stuff. And they decided we as the kids must be really tired. So they separated us into different cars. And so it was just my brother and I with one couple who didn't, I mean, I didn't understand at the time they were speaking English to me. It turns out they were speaking English to me, but I didn't. The accent was so strange. And so here I am thinking, oh, my gosh, I'm going to have to protect my brother. I don't know where we're going. I don't know what we're doing. And we get and my parents came considerably after we arrived. And it was this building it was a compound. So it was surrounded by this huge cement wall with broken glass in the front. Like all across the top and big bars on there. And they took us in and they put us in like two little school chairs, you know, like little elementary school wooden chairs with just the one handle right by the entrance. And then they shut this big gate and there was like a Bible on the, you know, desk. And I was like, oh no, we're in like, you know, Bible jail. Like, I don't know. What have we gotten ourselves into? Where are my parents? Are they coming here or are they going somewhere else? Like, is this just where they put kids? Like, what have we done wrong? You know, so the intro was a little bit terrifying.
And you thought you were going to be frolicking through the jungles of Indonesia barefoot.
Exactly. Yeah. And we were very much a nature family. We would go hiking all the time, camping all the time. And so that sounded exciting. This was like, whoa, this is way out of my realm. I don't know what we're doing here.
Did you like go to school? You said you did homeschool for a while. Like, you know, usually here we pivot to what was your high school experience like and where did you fit in? But you have a very non-traditional story. So what was high school for you?
Well, so actually my parents did try to put us in the elementary school when we got there. But it turns out we were on a very different schedule than them. So they were very far along in their school year when we arrived that first year. And the other thing is we were a rarity. I mean, white people in general in this part of town were a rarity, but kids were like nobody had seen white kids. And so they put us in the classroom and the classrooms there were huge, like 50 people. And even though this was a private school, you know, they were just big classes. And of course, most of it in Tagalog, very little bit in English. And the English was terrible. In fact, I got in trouble the first week for correcting my English teacher. And so it didn't go well. And they would come, and we lived on the compound where the school was. So at lunch, you know, and it's hot, there's no air conditioning. So the screen door was closed, but the door was open. And at lunch, everybody would come and press against our door to look at the white family eating. And within a week, they broke the door down from all the pressure of all these kids piled on our door. And I was, at that point, I was like, I'm not going to school there anymore. And so that's when we started homeschooling. When it became, and we never got our visas to Indonesia. So we ended up staying in the Philippines and eventually moving out to a different place than we had been there. And finally to Makati, which is the nicer part of town where the international school was, and so that we could actually go to school. And so when I went to middle school, I started attending the International School of Manila, and that's where ultimately I graduated from high school.
Did you have things like in high school, like high school dances and stuff? Was it like that, or was it?
Yeah. It was an American school. I mean, mostly American schools. I mean, there was a lot of Filipinos there, but there were people from all around the world, Australian, lots of Europeans.
Well, that then allows me to ask, so where did you fit in? You know, in high school, you kind of have a bucket that you fall in, or maybe there's a bit of blending. Which bucket were you in?
So sixth grade was my first, you know, intro back into school, and I would say it was disastrous. You know, up until that point, I had lived pretty much out in the woods, and all I owned were flip-flops and ripped up t-shirts and shorts, and we had to go shopping. I wasn't a shopper. I didn't know anything about fashion, and so I let my dad choose all my stuff. And so I ended up with these like tie-dyed Bermuda shorts and that I would wear with purple tennis shoes, like crazy.
So you were a hippie.
I was like the total reject, because at this school most kids were super rich and they were all like
button down
and Benetton and like totally preppy.
You were wearing like thrift store stuff. And, your dad got you.
And yeah. And I mean, and also, you know, my social skills were like not there really. And so people were making fun of me. And what they didn't expect though was that I spoke Tagalog. And so, you know, there was like these rich Filipino cliques. And immediately, you know, I'm like the first one by the door. I'm so excited to be at school, right? So I'm there with my books and I'm like by the door and I'm like, woo, I'm in school, like real school. This is so exciting. And they're just like making fun of me. And I turned around and I started talking Tagalog back and they were all like, oh, whoa, this is like unheard of.
Would you do sports? Do you do arts? Did you do music? Was a camera in your hand yet?
No, I didn't get a camera until way, way later, actually, not until I finished graduate school. I did get into sports. I played a lot of sports. Track was really kind of my main thing, but I loved soccer. I was on the soccer team. So I did get into sports, and I grew out of that kind of nerdy, like, oh my gosh, phase relatively quickly. And I kind of became re-socialized, I guess you could say. But also, I mean, I was in choir. So I did continue that line as well. And then I got in high school, I probably came even more to we spent 1 year in Denver when my freshman year of high school. And that was kind of eye-opening and was like, oh, there's a whole different world out there. And so I'd say by high school, you know, I didn't really fit into any of the buckets, but because I didn't fit precisely in any of them, I was able to kind of, you know, shift around them and got very active in, you know, student government and the spirit houses and, you know, all those things as well.
Were you kind of an oddity when you got to Denver?
Oh, I was, yeah.
I found it.
Oh, Jared found the song.
I'm pretty confident in this one. Cliff Richard from 1984. Should I play it?
Yeah, I'll tell you if it is it. Love. Oh, yeah. That's it.
Oh, I remember this.
I think I danced to this in eighth grade.
Yeah, this is the part that I'm like, oh, yep, that's it.
So explain how you were an oddity in Denver, how that went. You were there for a year. You did school.
Yeah. And I knew when I went, and we knew we were going back to the Philippines. We were there really because my grandfather was ill. And so my dad took a sabbatical and we spent it in Denver to be close to my grandfather. And you know, that's when I first started realizing that I was completely out of touch with American culture. Like, I had no idea what was going on here. So I got a little bit of catching up at that point. But also my parents, you know, they wanted me to go into a really good school, but I was going to a public school. We knew I was going back to the Philippines and I was going to do international baccalaureate. And the magnet school that I ended up going to in Denver was international baccalaureate. But it was like 90% African-American inner city school. Like, they had cops on the campus, and, you know, because there'd be huge fights at lunch between gangs and stuff. And like, they would make announcements over the radio, like, this is not childcare, don't bring your kids here. And of course, I'm coming from like this like international school where like nobody was even having sex. It was like, what? Like, what? People have kids? Like, and nobody, you know, there
oh, you mean
be,
students don't bring your yes, children.
Students,
oh,
don't bring I
that
your
kind
children.
Of went right over my
yeah,
head.
Yeah, no, we are not a daycare. Your kids need to stay at home. And it was like, wait, do people have kids at my age? Are you kidding me? You know, so it was like, and no, you know, there would be fights, of course, at international school, but it was like, you know, very minor. And this was meanwhile, like, people are, you know, cracking their heads and bringing guns and knives. And so I spent most of that year pretty terrified. And my brother was getting his head flushed down toilets. And so I spent a lot of it terrified. But the people I met in the international baccalaureate program, of course, were, you know, very smart, very cultured, worldly, you know. So it was kind of like I had my little enclave there. But the school overall was a little bit scary.
So then you went back and finished in the Philippines.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you went to college in Miami?
No,
you went to grad school in Miami.
I went
Miami.
To grad school. Yeah, I went to college in Richmond, Indiana.
What were you like aiming toward at that point?
The reason I chose that was because they had Forest on the campus. They had a Peace and Global Studies major, which I thought I wanted to do at the time. And they had these really strong international studies courses. So you could go to Kenya for a semester, which was very much something I wanted to do. And they had an organic farm. So it was like all these things. And I had no idea what winter was like. So I was like, yeah, Indiana sounds great. No problem. Until winter. And then winter hit. And I was like, oh, yeah, I got to get out of here as soon as possible.
Did you finish there?
I did finish there, but I finished there in 3 years. And I did spend one semester in Kenya. And I spent a May term in the Galapagos. And so I spent as much time as little winter there as I could.
What did you get your degree in?
Ended up being biology. My first Peace and Global Studies base course, it was very clear to me this was politics. And I was like, oh, no, I'm not into politics. And meanwhile, in the Philippines, the biology courses had all been very heavy into the genetics and the cellular, which I was like, yeah, that's not all that interesting to me. But when I got there, my very first class was an ecology class. And, you know, the labs where they were sending us out into the woods to identify trees. And I was like, oh, this I can do. This is cool. If this is biology, I can do biology. So that's how I got into biology. And in fact, there was a professor in particular who he's a herpetologist. And he's actually ultimately why I came down to Florida to study amphibians and reptiles, was because he was just so amazing to be out in the field with. And to, you know, like, he would catch a snake and toss it across the bush for a student to catch on the other side. And we'd all be like, what? And he'd, you know, grab it by the end of their tail and like bring him through his legs and grab the head on the other side. And he was just one of those people that made being out in the woods like the craziest, funnest adventure you'd ever been on.
Any musical memories linked to Indiana? Maybe some Mellencamp or something? Isn't he from there?
You know, my roommate always played, oh man. Oh, Respect.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T.
Yes, exactly. My roommate played that all my first year, like, incessantly.
Were you into music by then? Seems like you may not totally have been because you missed all the
stuff. No, I would say I love music, but I'm not one of those people that's just like avidly always seeking it, because I spent so much time where it was just kind of like peripheral, or you would, you know, make your own music. You know, it wasn't a listening activity necessarily.
Do you remember the first music you owned?
You know, ironically, the very first thing that was, well, my very first was like John Denver and the Muppets, but that like showed up in a Christmas stocking, but I loved it. I'd sing along all the time. The one that was first purchased for me was and I can't even believe in retrospect that my dad bought it for me, but it was Michael Jackson Thriller.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, but that's totally not the type of music my dad would be promoting. So I must have been really, really begging for it.
What about the first time you saw music performed live?
I mean, I saw lots of that, but mostly, you know, classical or, you know,
but like, you know, not that, you know, yeah, rock and roll
my first,
or something.
Yeah,
like
and
that.
I'm actually a little embarrassed. I got free tickets is why it was there, but it was Vanilla Ice.
Wow.
And
we were in the
front row. And so, like, you know, that's the thing about going to international school, right? All your friends are ambassadors' children and stuff. And so they're getting, like, free tickets to these things. And, like, the sweat was just, like, pouring on us. And we were both like, ew, gross.
I was there then, too. Not in the Philippines. But you couldn't not like that song.
I mean, I don't know.
We did not like it, ironically, as strange as that is to say in retrospect.
Yeah. No, and it was before he had his downfall. That's absolutely true. And it was exciting. It was a huge stadium, and there were, you know, thousands of people, and, you know, it was one of my first...
I could see him dancing.
Oh, yeah. And there was, like, lights, and, yeah, it was crazy. And, you know, my friend's driver brought us there, so it was just her and I, and it felt like this big outing, you know.
Did you go straight from Indiana to grad school?
I worked for a year in Michigan first.
Doing biology stuff?
Actually working at a drug rehabilitation clinic. It was a research and rehabilitation, and one of my friend's parents was the one that was running it. And so to kind of give me an opportunity to be in the research world. And so I lived with them and I worked for them for a year as I was kind of trying to decide what was next. And that's when I decided I was going to do continue in biology and learned about the tropical biology program at Florida International University, which is ultimately where I went for graduate school.
Had you ever been to Miami or Southeast Florida prior to that?
I had not.
First memory.
No.
Memory. First take on
Well, actually,
on that
it was
world.
Again, it kind of goes back to my Manila looking out the plane. It was a similar thing. I flew in for my interview and I was looking down at the city as I was flying in, and it was, you know, all the lights and the glitz and the beaches, and it was like, wow. Okay, this looks exciting.
So you didn't even visit campus before you...
No, that was for my interview. Okay. Yeah, that was when I came down for my interview.
We're going to do your second song here in a second, but I pulled this off of... I went through and looked at the script that I had prepared from when you were on Gulf Coast Life. So I've got some questions that I kind of have imported.
Awesome.
When you were in grad school in Miami, you studied poison dart frogs in Costa Rica and rock iguanas in the Bahamas?
I did indeed.
Tell us just a short version of the poison dart frog story.
So I was interested in looking at sexual selection. And this particular frog is really good for doing that because sexual selection is all about the females being picky. And this system, they're very picky because the females leave the eggs on land with the male in his territory. And he essentially watches the eggs. And then when they've hatched into little tadpoles, she comes back and she puts them on her back and carries them up into the trees and puts them in the leaves of bromeliads in the little pools of water in there. And she feeds them. And so she comes up and she slaps the water and she recognizes their vibration back and she feeds them for 9 weeks. So she has every reason to be picky, right? She wants a male who can do this. And then she's going to invest a lot in these babies until they come out as little tadpoles. So I was looking, I was actually recording their songs. I was recording their calls and looking to see if there were any cues in their calls that the females might be picking up on that would relate to their fitness.
How does she get the eggs on her back? That's all I can think about. There's like little frog arms. Does she roll onto it?
I never saw that process, but she does have like a sticky substance that comes off on her back that they, I'm assuming they somehow know to squiggle up on her back. I never actually saw that.
Was grad school a lot of going to places like that?
Yeah, I got to go to Costa Rica several times. The first time was a general tropical biology course, so I got to go several different places. And then I went back two more times for a couple months to do my actual research on my frogs. And then in the Bahamas, I was working on the ecology of the rock iguanas. And it's an endemic iguana, only occurs on a couple islands in the Bahamas. And so for two summers in a row, I got to camp out there, and we were looking at their nesting. Nobody had studied their nesting before, and this was actually working with the professor from undergraduate who had gotten me really excited about amphibians and reptiles. So I camped with him and another graduate student, and we were there for 2 summers in a row, about 5 weeks, camped on the island, and it's a remote desert island. We were really desperate for cold water by the end. We had this bad tank of like Nassau water we brought with us, and it tasted so bad that we were drinking it as like Tang the whole time, or like lemon, you know, just any kind of Gatorade, anything to flavor it. And so by the end we were just like, if boaters would show up, we'd be like, can we please have some cold water? Like,
an ice cube, please.
Yeah.
Do you get swept into any musical stylings in Miami? That's a very musical town.
It is, and ironically, probably less musical for me than most places.
Just because that was just not your scene?
Well, yeah, I was, you know, spending most of my time outdoors or camping, or, you know, so I just really wasn't spending a lot of time in the music scene.
Do you ever play music when you guys are out in the world doing expedition-y stuff? Is that, is that a thing? I would think not when you're like trying to be quiet in the woods.
Yeah, no, definitely not. In fact, I used to always have music in the background, but as I've gone into being a biologist and even more so as a photographer, I've gotten more and more into silence. I don't listen to much anymore. And I've found now when, you know, I used to be able to work to music, I did everything to music. And now I can't even write with music in the background. I'm like, unless it's like just instrumental, if there's words that I start paying attention, right? Partly, I guess, because I haven't been listening to it so much. So it's not background anymore. If I'm listening to it, I'm really listening to it. And so, yeah, I don't do a whole lot of listening to music.
Did you ever take like a whole month off and just listen to 80s hits?
No. In fact, in general, it's kind of funny. Like, most of my friends are like, oh, the 80s, and they love it. They're like, oh, we're dancing. I don't really get into the 80s.
Yeah.
I like the 90s. The 90s was kind of, that's probably when I was first being introduced to pop music. And there's a lot of songs from the 90s that I love. But the 80s, every time it goes on, I'm like, yeah, not so much.
Okay, we will get to your pivot from biology to photography, but let's do song two first. Play it or tell a story?
Play it first.
All right, this is song number two from our guest today, photographer and writer and biologist Kirsten Hines. This is I'm Like a Bird by Nelly Furtado from her album Whoa Nelly, released in 2000. This is Three Song Stories. It's biography through music.
That one I love, actually, compared to the last one. I'm like, oh, I feel so good now. That one takes me to Nambung National Park in Western Australia. And actually, this is a good pivot from the biology to the photography, because right after graduate school, I got my master's degree in biology, and I was kind of like, I don't really know what I want to do next. I don't want a PhD, but I kind of need to find myself, right? And so I left Miami, and as I was leaving Miami, my fellow graduate students gave me my first ever camera. And it was this little point and shoot, but I realized very quickly that I loved photography. And I upgraded it pretty fast to like a fancier one. It wasn't an SLR yet, but it was, you know, much more advanced. And so I was traveling all over Australia. I had gone to New Zealand, and I was traveling all over Australia, writing, doing a lot of photography, volunteering on biology trips. And at this point, I had been out for almost a year and in Australia for most of that. I'd spent two months in New Zealand, and most of this was in Australia. But my funds were starting to run low. And so when I was in Sydney, I had gone in to interview. But I didn't want to stop traveling. I mean, just kind of like once you get out there and you're wandering around on your own, living out of a backpack, you sort of start feeling like, how can I stop doing this? Like, the momentum's there, and you meet people and you travel with them for a while, or you go volunteer on this project for a while, and you just can't imagine going back. But I knew my funds were running low. So I had interviewed for this job with a travel company in Sydney. And this was a few months later, and they contacted me just as I got to Western Australia, met up with two Australian friends who had never been to Western Australia either. And we were getting ready to start what was going to be this like epic road trip across Western Australia. And this literally, I got this call the day I arrived in Perth, and they were like, we're offering you a job guiding through South America. We need you to leave immediately, though, and you're going to need to take Spanish classes, but we want you to start immediately. So to take the job, I was going to have to abandon this road trip with my friends. And I also at that point had set up, I was going to meet somebody in Borneo, and then I was going to go visit a friend in Thailand. And I had, you know, the next several months planned out. And I was just like, I was so torn because I was like, this seemed like the perfect job to keep me out traveling in the woods. And yet, I've already set up all this cool stuff. And so it became this like massive decision, and I was having a really hard time with it.
I was getting, but you weren't deciding between going to a desk job and that. You were deciding between going to South America and guiding.
I know, but nonetheless, it felt like that was okay, the responsible thing to do, right? Like, there's money there.
Right,
like, it wouldn't have been a lucrative job, but at least I would have had guaranteed food, housing, and income.
Right,
whereas
right.
I was living very
much. You were
much,
a vagabond.
I was very much a vagabond. And so I, but meanwhile, we were like, okay, I've got a couple days to decide this. So, you know, we did just a couple things around close to Perth. And Nambung National Park is one of these that's not too far away. And, you know, I was agonizing it. And we go out, and this park is amazing. I mean, it's, and talk about really using my camera that day, too. It was like the sun was setting, and there's these huge limestone pinnacles that are rising out of this all-sand desert. And there's ripples in the sand, and it's this orange sand, and it's contrasted with these, like, I mean, these statues basically just emerging. And then in the distance, you can see the blue ocean. I mean, it was just incredibly beautiful. And this song was playing as we were driving through it. And I just remember that refrain when she was like, I'm like a bird, you know, I don't know where my home is, you know. And I was like, that's me. Oh my God, that's so me. And I literally, like, went halfway out the window. I was like, arms out in the wind, the wind's coming at me, and I'm like, I'm staying! I'm free! Like, we're going to go see whale sharks! Like, forget South America!
And it was all because of Nelly.
It was, I mean, really, like, that helped me make the decision. I was like, that's it! I'm free! I'm gonna be free!
Was that the pivot between biologist and photographer?
I mean,
that's
was,
the pivot between slightly more responsible and...
No, I think I had been building... I mean, I think it took a long time to make that full transition. I mean, I remember for the longest time I was really doing photography, and yet I kept saying, well, I'm a biologist. And people would be like, but what research are you doing? I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm not really doing research anymore. You know, I really was struggling with that for quite some time. So that was probably partway through the transition. I knew I wanted to be a photographer and a writer. I didn't know how to get there. And I was still doing some, you know, biology research, volunteer projects and stuff. And so that was kind of in the middle point where I was like, I know this is where I want to go. I have no idea how to go there.
That camera you were shooting on would have been film, right?
No, it wasn't. It was
there
digital.
Was digital then? It must have been a pretty crappy digital though,
it was
for
very
2000, 2001.
It was a very crappy digital.
And that
in
was
fact,
like a 1 megapixel.
Yeah,
probably.
And I didn't realize how bad it was until I
looks
volunteered.
Good if you blow it up to an inch across.
I volunteered at a bat house in Queensland, and I was like, oh, I'll make you a sign. And I took pictures for him, and I tried to blow up the picture onto the sign, and I was like, oh, wow, what happened to my picture? It's like all pixelated. It was like horrible. I was like, okay, that's not going to work.
So another thing I pulled off of your bio here, let's just go through. I want to get a short story of one or two of these things. You get to choose between stashed under thorny bushes in Kenya, lunch stolen by monkeys in Borneo, battling crocodiles in Australia, facing down a bowl of boiled frogs in China, and rounding out the continents with penguins in Antarctica. Which of those would you like to tell
us?
Okay,
well, the crocodile has to do with song three, so we'll hold
okay,
off
we'll
on
put
that.
On, we'll put crocodile on
yeah,
hold.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us about the facing down boiled frog, bowl of boiled frogs.
Okay. That's a good
it's like
one.
An Indiana Jones scene.
So, and actually that's relevant too, because that was part of this time of like, I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know what I was doing. I was traveling. And just as I was truly about to really run out of money, and I'm in Vietnam, I'm on Ha Long Bay, which if you've ever seen pictures, it's beautiful limestone cliffs coming out of the ocean. It's a very calm ocean. And it's kind of on the border. You can see China across the way. But it's the tropical part of China. And I get an email right? Just before I got on that boat, actually, I got this email from somebody in Australia that I had met who said, are you still on the road? Because I have a friend in China who's looking for an English teacher. Do you want to go to China? And I was like, looking across this beautiful tropical bay. And I was like, yeah, sounds great. And try as I may, I couldn't find a map in English of China while I was in Vietnam. And so I couldn't look up where this place was. So I said, okay, I'll go. No problem. Like, yeah, let's do this. And, you know, typical, like at that stage, I was like, just jump. It'll work out. And so I finally get an email from my dad. He's like, do you know where you've agreed to go to? And I was like, yeah, China. He's like, yeah, Siberia.
I was going to say, yeah. China's a big place.
And it turns out it was the town called Huma, which was in Heilongjiang province, which is like the farthest north, literally across the river from Siberia, north of Mongolia. And I had agreed to be there through part of the winter. And so it was, and this was another situation where I get there and
you're like, Indiana's prepared me for this.
Yeah, there you go. Indiana prepared me for this. That's exactly right. But yeah, I get there and, you know, it was another situation where like they had seen, you know, Russians across the river and occasional Russian tourists, but they'd never met an American before. And so everywhere I went, I had flocks of children following me, and it took me a long time to realize that the fellow English teachers were speaking English. It was like, you sound
like
you're speaking
Chinese.
It's
like a theme in your life.
Yeah. So, but because I was the big celebrity in town, everybody wanted to invite me to dinner. And mostly, it turns out, I didn't know this at the time, but I discovered that the Communist Party had been regulating who I could go to dinner with. But I gave a talk at the elementary school, and one of the little girls came up afterwards and asked me if I would go to her house for dinner. And I said yes. And the Communist Party hadn't heard about this. And so I was literally sneaked into her house like late at night. We had to go through back alleys to get there so that we weren't spotted. And they lived in the bad part of town, which I had never been allowed to see before. And they were these, I mean, we're talking, it's really cold. It's really cold.
Yeah.
And they're living in mud huts.
What time of year is this? This is winter.
This was December when this happened. And so, yeah, I mean, my little apartment was above the market, and I had been watching, like, you know, beautiful fresh produce. And then, you know, it was like down to just cabbage and meat. That was it. There was nothing else there available. And every, you know, stairwell you'd go in, they'd have like salted cabbage, because when the cabbage was gone, that was it. You were going to eat the salted version of it. I mean, that's all that was there. And meanwhile, like all the guys on their motorcycles, they started off, you know, barehanded. And by the end, they had these huge gloves that they would attach to the handlebars that were just stiff cotton, like really like layers and layers of cloth to keep warm. And they would stick their arms into that as they were driving because it was so cold. So this house, I mean, you never took your winter coat off when you were in this house. And they were very poor, and it was clear that they had nothing. And I walk in, and there's this giant bowl of boiled bullfrogs on the dinner table. And I was like, oh, you, first of all, like
whole bullfrogs.
Whole bullfrogs, yeah.
Boiled.
Like boiled, whole legs splayed out.
Kind of like pasty looking.
Oh no, they were pretty green.
Oh, I would think they would pasty up when they boiled.
I don't know how they managed it, but they almost looked alive. Like they were very lifelike looking, and they're all there, like overflowing. And first of all, I had been trying to tell people the whole time I lived there, I was like, I don't eat meat. I don't eat meat. I don't eat meat. Right? This was like my refrain in Chinese from the time I got there. And any number of meals, I just had to eat ice cream because there's nothing else. Because to honor a guest there, you always ordered meat. But also, I had been telling all of my students that, you know, I study amphibians and reptiles, and I would draw a frog on the board. And I said, oh, you do know that I don't eat meat, and I study frogs, right? And they're like, yes, this is why we got these for you. You like frogs. I was like, right, not like that, but okay. But then, how could I offend them, right? I mean, they had clearly gone out of their way.
This is straight out of Indiana Jones, because there's that one scene where they're like, you must not offend him, Indy. I mean,
well, nobody was telling me that, but I was like, oh my gosh, how can I offend these people? They probably spent their entire month's salary on this, you know? And I did have a translator with me, and fortunately, so I was like, oh, thank you so much. I'm so honored, you know? And I'm watching them, and they're literally like, they didn't take the legs off. They just bite right into the body, and you'd watch like the eyes bulge forward, and like the, you know, the innards are like shifting through the frog, and I'm like, oh God, I'm like looking at this thinking, I really don't think I can do this. Like, I really don't think I can do this. And, but I managed to pick one up and like eat off the leg and was like, oh, it's so good. It's so good. You know, and everybody was so impressed, and they all got distracted by bringing out shots because that was so good that I ate that. And then they're bringing out shots. And while they were distracted getting the shots, my translator switched plates with me. So it looks like I ate my frog and I got his bones and he got my frog. And I was so thankful to him.
I'm going to pick the biologist's brain a little bit here. I wouldn't think that frogs could live in Siberia. I guess frogs can live in Siberia.
Well, I mean, if you walked into any restaurant, any shop, they had terrariums full of this stuff.
Oh, so they're like raising them for food.
Yeah.
They're not...
Although I will say, so I had one, I mean, they never let me go anywhere by myself, but we had one break that I thought I was going to go to Mongolia actually as a tourist during that period. But they didn't tell us when the vacation was. So I couldn't make any plans because it kept moving, right? And then suddenly I come back from lunch and they're like, oh, no, vacation just started and classes are done. We'll come back on this time. So I'm like scrambling to organize stuff. And as I'm trying to organize it, all of these people in the village were like, oh, no, you can't go by yourself. We'll come with you. And it became such an ordeal that I finally was like, okay, I'm not going. I'll just stay here. So I did take one day to go hiking. And the thing that was really depressing on that day was it was my first time walking beyond the village up into the woods. There was nothing alive. I mean, everything had been killed, even insects. There was nothing, not a bird, nothing.
Killed by human activity and or freezing temperatures?
I think eaten. I mean, you know, there's animals adjusted to freezing. So I saw the woman I play ping pong with every morning at 4 a.m. before school. Well, it felt like 4. It probably wasn't 4 but it was dark. It was like always dark. She had always wore really high heels, and she speared the only and only live mouse I saw. She speared it with her heel. I was like, okay.
I like the picture of playing ping pong in Siberia pre-dawn. we got to do your third song, but real quick, we first met because you were on Gulf Coast Life talking about your book Wild Florida and Animal Odyssey. How's it going? It's been out for, what, 5 months now?
Yeah, and it's going really well, and it just won 2 awards, actually.
What?
It got gold medal in visual arts for the Florida Book Awards, and then it also got nonfiction book award from the National League of American Pen Women, first place in that. And that one, actually, they never even saw the pictures. It was just based on the writing. So.
Awesome. Congratulations.
Yeah. Very excited about that.
Huh.
Thank you.
There's one question I didn't get to ask you during Gulf Coast Life, so I'm going to ask you now. Can you tell us about the northern curly-tailed lizard named Tuffy?
Well, that goes back to the camping on the islands in the Bahamas, studying iguanas there. And we had a kitchen tent set up, and we had all of our cans and stuff in there, mostly to protect them from the hermit crabs, because the hermit crabs would eat off all the labels and then you had no idea what was in a can. So we had this like screened in tent set up to protect our food. But Tuffy was a little curly tail lizard that lived there. He'd lost his tail, so it didn't curl anymore, but he was huge, and he was just such a tough little lizard. He would chase off iguanas that were like 3 times his size, a mockingbird all the time, you know, and every time we'd sit down to eat our little peanut butter and jelly, he would come roaring over, chasing off everything else, and like sometimes he'd end up on your knee trying to tug the sandwich right out of your hand. So he got nicknamed Tuffy because he was a little badass. What can I say?
My grandparents' dog that passed away a few years ago, his name was Tuffy. It was a cute little old schnoodle.
I don't even know what a schnoodle is.
It's a mix of a schnauzer and a poodle.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Did he have all his tail?
He had like a little, like a stubby tail. You know what I mean? Like just
so, yeah,
short,
they were kindred spirits.
Yeah, no, this one had a little stubby tail too. Aww. Yeah. That's awesome.
Okay. Time for song 3, which this band has shockingly little information on the internet about it.
Really?
So, yeah. So tell us, you want to play it or you want to tell a story?
Well, I'll tell a story afterwards. But this, so I was in Australia when this happened. And so maybe it's an Australian band.
Well, you'd think the internet would still have Australian bands.
You would think so.
Is it Tommy?
Tommy.
Okay, yeah. This is Kirsten Hines' final song on Three Song Stories this week. This is Blah 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 by Tommy and the Neighborhood, spelled with a U. I guess that's the Australian influence.
Yeah.
From the 2003 album No Sugar Added. So what's the story with that one?
So, you know how I said it took a long time to go from, like, I've decided I'm going to be a writer and photographer to, like, oh, I'm there. So I actually ended up back in Florida working as a biologist after my backpacking around the world episode. But this was somebody I had, a friend of mine that I had met in Australia, was working on her PhD project in Western Australia, but in the Broome area, so north, very far north. And so she invited me to come be her field tech. And so I took time off work here as a biologist to go join her. And we were working on purple crown fairy wrens, which if you've never seen them are...
Purple crown fairy...
Wrens.
Wrens, W, like birds.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're adorable. They're beautiful little birds. And the males get these bright purple crowns and they've got blue on them. And they're as sexy birds get. And they're tiny. And so we had been...
as sexy birds get. So go ahead.
You know what I mean.
I totally know what you mean, yeah.
So anyway, I had been there for a few months helping her, a couple months. And we would fly. Oh, sometimes we would hike. Sometimes we would fly. But we were going to very remote locations on this river system. And we would set up mist nets. And so one night... we were set up and camping, and we could tell there was a whole lot of crocodiles in the water. You can see the red eye shine at night. And so we said, wow, there's a lot of crocodiles here. But we knew there were no saltwater crocodiles. And if you're in Australia, that's the one to be worried about. That one can and does eat people all the time. The freshwater crocodile is a fish eater, so it's got a very slender snout, so not so much to worry about. And in fact, Australians swim with them all the time. But I was a little bit nervous about that. So we got up at like 4 in the morning, hiked way, way out to the end of where we were going to be doing our monitoring. And we were working our way back and it was really hot. And so my friend kept saying, should we swim here? And I'd be like, remembering all those crocodile eyes, I was like, no, I don't think so. Finally, after lunch, she was like, it's freaking hot. We are getting in the water now. So we went swimming and there was a crocodile and it bit me. In fact, it tried to death roll me and my friend had to yank me out of the water.
Where did it get you?
Yeah. So it got me on my knee and in fact, I got in the water first and this was they call them billabongs. They're water holes.
That's
what that word means. Huh. Yeah, it's not just a surf brand. And so this one had a steep side, and I wasn't confident I could get out, but I finally saw, well, there's a part over here with a limb. I think I can crawl it if I need to. But I had jumped in before her, and she'd gone off to see if maybe there was a better spot to get in. And once I got in, I was like, oh, you're right. We should have totally gotten in a long time ago. It's so nice in here. And then she jumps in. And when she jumps in, two archer fish. Do you know archer fish?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they're the ones that like
have spit. Insects out of the sky above their heads.
Exactly. Well, two of them like went flying out of the water. She just turned sheet white. She's like, we got to get out of the water now.
Because that's like crocodile sign.
She was like that. Yeah, this is not good. And so she was closer to the bank because she had just gotten in. She got out. I start swimming to shore. And I hit this thing that seems like this mossy log, and I don't remember it being there before. So first I scream, and then I'm like, oh, it's just a mossy log, it's fine. But then I feel pain on my knee, and I lift my knee, and there's this crocodile there. And so it was the weirdest thing, because in my head, I went completely calm.
How big was this crocodile?
We'll get there.
Okay.
I did not know at this point. I didn't know. And so I just see this head, and in my head, I was completely calm and logical, and I was like, you got this, Kirsten. You worked with crocodiles in Florida, you know what to do. You just need to like close its mouth and you can put him under your, they've got a really weak jaw opening it. So you can just tuck him underneath your arm and swim to shore and then get out and I'll be fine, Meanwhile, I'm like trying to pull his jaws off of my knee and I'm watching his teeth come through my fingers. And I'm like, oh, right. But right now I'm working against all of his muscles. Yeah, like, this isn't working. And I look up and I see my friend. She's offshore. She's gotten out of the water, of course. And she's stretching out to me and giving me her hand. And I'm like, oh, that's good. She'll save me. We're good. And at that moment, I feel it's starting to death roll. And its tail shows up on shore. My friend's 6 foot something. She's reaching towards me, and there's still a foot between us. So I'm like, oh, my gosh, this thing's like 7 foot long. This is not a small crocodile. This is big. But because I was aware of the death roll, I was able to roll the other way and not have it do that. And I get this total adrenaline rush. I mean, in the moment when she couldn't rescue me, I was like, it's you or me, buddy, and you are not winning. So somehow I managed to swim to shore with the crocodile on my leg. I lift my leg to the bank, and my friend was like, eyes, I've got to get the eyes. And she just somehow knew she had to get the eyes. And she told me later she had poked her fingers through the eye sockets and was actually touching her fingers between its eyes underneath. So crocodile lets go of me. Meanwhile, there's now blood all over in the water, and I feel pain on my hand. And I lift my arm, and there's a second crocodile on my arm, much, much smaller one.
It's a crocodile frenzy.
Yeah, and I'm screaming. I mean, like, see my friends holding the other crocodile still, and I'm screaming at her. I'm like, don't drop it, don't drop it, don't drop it. Of course, she drops it because she's now looking at me. I've got another crocodile on me. Unfortunately, this one was much smaller. I was able to bash it against the wall there, not the wall, but the bank of the river, and she grabs me and yanks me out. And it was a very long rescue after that involved, you know, she had to go use the satellite phone, and I'm like laying there and I can hear the crocodile in the water. And fortunately, it's a steep bank, so it can't get up there. But one of the cool things about this was two of the animals I had studied while I was in Australia, one was a flying fox. And they don't normally fly during the day. But all of a sudden, as I'm laying there and my friend's nowhere near because she's gone to get a signal for the satellite phone, one came and landed in a tree above me. And then we had been studying purple crown fairy wrens, and a little male came and sat on the other side of me. And I felt like, okay, these are my guardians.
It was another Snow White moment.
Yeah, I was like, my little guardians have come to protect me.
Was one of the fox or the bird or the crocodile singing this song?
No. Where the song comes in is it was a very long recovery. I had to get brought out of there. And they had to helicopter me. And then the flying doctor service took me to the nearest hospital. And there was trucks involved. It was a very long, long recovery. But this was actually a couple weeks later. I was flying back to the U.S. On the ticket I had, I mean, I was supposed to leave then anyway. And so this group of women that had become friends of mine at the field station, they all decided they were going to come with me and support me. And so we were road tripping back, and it was a long drive. It's like 8 hours from there to Broome, which is where I was catching a flight. And all of these women came with me, and in the car, this song kept playing over and over, and they were all like dancing to it and singing to it. And, you know, those 2 weeks had been really tough. Trying to just heal and mentally being in this field station, but no longer being able to function. And, you know, it was not the best period of my life. But to be on that road trip back and having this song playing and looking back and seeing all of these women smiling and dancing to it. And then we had one nice camping evening right out on the beach. We all slept out under the stars on the beach, and we had listened to this song literally all day. So this was kind of like my, you know, the beginning of rejuvenation and hope, and it was just a really hopeful song.
At least they weren't playing Crocodile Rock.
There you go.
I just want to cut in real quick for I don't know how long we were on the air, like live, but I will be very confident that when you said as sexy as a bird can get, made it into the air. And I figured I added into the episode.
How on earth? I mean,
You
didn't hit the button.
You can take over.
So somebody over there accidentally mashed a button and put the conversation we were having on live on WGCU in 12 Florida counties.
Awesome. Sexy birds it is.
This is an unprecedented experience for this show.
This is the first time it's happened.
I could tell something was going on when Richard and Mike stuck their head in.
Well, I hope I didn't hit anything.
No, you didn't do anything.
Nothing within these rooms hit anything to cause that to happen, but I just thought it was funny and I wanted to bring it up.
Do you have like a killer crocodile scar on your knee?
I have a crocodile scar on my knee, and in fact, it was one of the ways. So I published a paper on freshwater crocodile attacks afterwards because, like I said, Australians still swim with them. They think they're totally safe, but after I got attacked, I heard several other people had been attacked. So I ended up writing a paper, and they kept trying to tell me that, no, that paper's not valid. It was probably a saltwater crocodile. And in fact, it was the scar on my knee that convinced them otherwise because it was thin enough.
That's like Jaws when they measure the bite radius.
I've never seen Jaws. Probably just as well.
You probably haven't seen Indiana Jones either, have you?
I have seen Indiana Jones.
Oh, I couldn't tell the way I referred to it.
I was thinking maybe that was part
of your cultural dark hole.
No, I saw that one in high school, so yeah.
Do you have a phobia around that kind of wildlife now?
Or, I mean, it seems like comfortable around crocodiles, but I don't swim much anymore. And I used to snorkel all the time. I now recognize how vulnerable I am underwater. And so, especially if it's dark water, I just can't get in. But I basically don't swim much anymore. Hmm. And I used to be a water baby. I mean, I was always in the water, and I don't anymore. But in terms of phobia, the animals, not at all.
All right. You ready for a speed round?
Uh-oh. Okay.
Do you have a nickname that has stuck over the course of your life you'd be willing to share?
I have never had a nickname.
When was the last time you purchased music that had physical form?
You mean like a CD or something? Wow. Probably graduate school.
Do you do karaoke?
I have done karaoke. You don't get to live in China without doing karaoke.
Were you doing, what kind of songs would you do when you were over there?
It was American music.
Do you remember what you sung, sang?
No. Yeah. No, but I also did one in Australia, and I don't remember what song that one was either, but a group of us were there for a frog survey, and there was one small group of us that were supposed to go really far, and we got completely thwarted, and we ended up coming back. We were supposed to stay out for a couple nights, and we ended up coming back early, and we went to the bar, and they were having karaoke night, and so we did it. And the way that the guy that really wanted to do it convinced all of us to join us was, he said, nobody will ever see you again. We're out in the middle of nowhere in Australia. Well, it turns out the only ATM in town, we walk in, and she's like, oh, it's the karaoke singers. And I was like, damn you. You said we would never be seen again.
They didn't have, John Denver and Kermit on the karaoke, did they?
Not.
You could have seen,
no.
You could have woven in some frog song. If you were a championship wrestler, what music would you enter the arena with?
Ooh. Not blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that's a little lighthearted.
That's a little too, yeah. I mean, it would probably have to be the Rocky song.
Okay. What would your wrestler name be?
I have no idea.
That's fine. Is a hot dog a sandwich? You said you don't eat meat, so this is maybe not a question that you're prepared for.
It's definitely not.
You can still have an opinion.
I guess I would consider it a sandwich, yeah.
If you had to guess, what would you say is the song you've listened to the most times?
I'm sure it's a church song. I'm sure it's a church song. All those years of being a pastor's daughter, you listen to a lot.
What activities or pursuits make you lose track of time the most?
Oh, photographing wildlife. I get completely lost in that. I have no idea that it's been hours.
Dream location to shoot wildlife and or dream animal or plant to capture?
I mean, I really love being in the rainforest because you just never know what's going to emerge from the trees, right? You have no idea. So that's probably my favorite. And I love being surprised by things I don't recognize, like weird animals. Like, actually, I was in Singapore last year. And this troop of monkeys scared a Malayan colugo out of the trees. Have you ever heard of that?
Mm-mm.
Yeah. It's this really cool mammal. It's a gliding mammal. It's about, sort of yay big. I don't know how you would say a couple feet. And this one was a mom with a baby. And they just came gliding through the forest and boom, land on the tree in front of me. They were amazing.
It's like Endor.
I can show you. I can show you a picture.
It's a Kaluga.
Milan Kalugo.
Cool.
Kalugo, and it's a flying mammal.
Yeah. So gliding. Like, it's a gliding mammal.
But like, sort of like the fox squirrel. I mean,
the flying squirrels. Yeah, but this is like many times larger than that.
And it can fly. It can glide with a baby with it.
Yep. The baby hangs on tight. Yeah. Yeah. So in fact, the picture I took of it is right now in the North American Nature Photography Association's 2024 showcase.
Hmm.
You could see it online.
Huh.
Do you know Dr. Jackson with the Wild Things?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, talk
woodpecker.
This way.
Woodpecker guy, right?
Yeah, woodpecker yep. guy.
Yeah. No, I've met him. He's very cool. He's fun.
Yeah, I help produce his show, and he has great photos, too. I just figured I'd mention while we were on the subject.
I'm glad you brought that up because I didn't get a chance to insert it. But, you know, I was thinking that second song of yours, I'm Like a Bird, we could get Jerry. We could use, like generative AI to do, like make a music video of Jerry Jackson with that song playing.
Him singing that song?
That's awesome.
I'm going to ask him next week if he'll just, like, want to do a cover of it.
Yeah, he comes in here and he records. We do a weekly thing where every week. This week we're focusing on the turtles with the
soft
noses.
Soft nosed turtle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Soft shelled.
Soft shelled turtle.
Turtle.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah.
Yep.
Next week is
Spanish moss.
Yeah.
Fun.
Yeah. If you could broadcast a song magically into the head of all humans in one big collective musical moment, which song would it be?
Probably Nora Jones, Come Away With Me.
Do you have a favorite band? Seems like maybe you don't have a favorite band.
No, I don't. I just kind of drift. Whatever feels right in the moment.
Is there a song that you wish you could hear again for the first time ever?
Not off the top of my head.
What would your 14-year-old self in the Philippines think of who you are today and what you've done in the intervening years?
Well, I can assure you she had no idea what was coming. So probably wouldn't have been surprised by anything because she was like, whatever.
Would she be surprised that you were still, I mean, you're not really, you know, you live in the United States now. Would that have been a surprise? Did your 14-year-old self think that this Philippine stuff was just an interlude, or did you even think that far ahead?
I mean, I knew I wasn't going to stay in the Philippines. I didn't know necessarily that I was going to stay in the U.S. That's part of why I did the international baccalaureate degree, because that would have allowed me to go to school in Europe if I wanted to. And I just really wasn't sure where I was going to end up. In fact, when I went to Australia, I thought I was going to end up in Australia. I was thinking that's what I was going to do.
Okay, it's time to recommend three people that you'll share this with that you think we might be able to get on.
All right. So I am sharing three different people. One is Grant Livingston. He is a great Florida folk music writer and singer who I've met doing conservation work around the Miami area. Another one is DeBlois Millage, who is actually one of the first people I ever met in Miami. And she's also a wonderful singer and songwriter. And I've had so many fun adventures with her, sleeping out on beaches and whatever. So she's the next. And then the third, I had to really twist arm for this one. But her name's Anne Ross, and she lives in the Golden Gate Estates. And it's her home that I crashed at while taking pictures of the bears. Yes. So she's got this wonderful property that gets bears and turkeys and all kinds of fun stuff. And she's got both her and her husband, they have all of these really fun stories. She grew up in Naples, and they have all these fun stories about Southwest Florida back in the day. So I'm hoping that she would. I'm glad she agreed to let me give you her name.
Well, do what you can. And then if you guys are listening, we want you on the show. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, this has been a lot of fun, though. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for doing it. For this week's Parting Tune, we're going back 1 year to episode number 266 with Karen Parsons, best known for playing Hillary on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. These days, she writes books for kids and young adults, including her novel How High the Moon, which was inspired by her mom's stories of growing up in South Carolina during Jim Crow. Her second song delved into the foundation of her philosophy on life, born out of the 1972 record album and TV special Free to Be You and Me. She said her family listened to it all the time. She even performed songs from it at their local YWCA. She said it was just their soundtrack to life.
It was all inclusivity. It was all celebrating all people in all of our ways. And it was, it was just really a beautiful, I think, just a philosophy of love and life, right? And I still very much, this is very much a part of me. It's who I am. And so this song, this album means so much to me. But then so many of the songs, you know, Rosie Greer's It's All Right to Cry. And they're really great, sweet songs that were teaching kids about everybody being accepted for who they are, whoever they are.
And this was like the early 70s is when it came out.
Yeah. And William Likes a Doll. There was a whole sketch, and there was a great sketch with Marlo Thomas and Mel Brooks where they play the babies. Yeah. Do you remember that? And they're the two babies, and they're talking about you're a boy and I'm a girl and whatever. And by the end of it, and he's like, you know, because he likes trucks and he likes this and that, and so therefore he's a boy. It's obvious I'm a boy. And then they find out at the end that actually it's the other way around. And so all the stereotypes are out the window. And I learned all this stuff early, and it stuck with me, and it made so much sense to me. So this song, which is the title of the whole thing, it will always be a very important song for me.
We make Three Song Stories in the studios of WGCU Public Radio on the campus of Florida Gulf Coast University in Fort Myers, Florida. Richard Chinqui is co-creator and producer. Tara Callaghan is host and online content producer. Our production assistant is Jared the Intern Gonzalez. Chris Duff is his executive producer. And our theme song was made by Dave Cowan and Stick Martin at Monkey House Studio in St. Pete. Keep listening.